potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio, and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films Elvis, The Black Phone, Marcel the Shell with Shoes On, The Man from Toronto, and Loot. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring the bad guys. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The first piece of news is looking at the box office from this past week, and what happened to Lightyear? Everybody's like, oh, it bombed in the box. And first of all, Lightyear did not bomb. Now, Lightyear did not live up to expectations, but it made $50 million over the weekend. That's not a bomb. $50 million is nothing to sneeze at. It's just not at the level that they were expecting. But what happened? Of course, everybody's like, is it the lesbian kiss that, oh my gosh, is it because Tim Allen wasn't in it and are people boycotting Disney? And, well, no. I don't think it has anything to do with that. I'm sure there are people who probably stayed away and sure there are people that are indignant about it. And yeah, it didn't open in the United Arab Emirates. But I don't think that's what's going on. I think that those people, they're in the vast minority. I think what happened to it, you got to look at two different things, the movie and the marketplace. The first is the movie itself. One of the things I ran into when I was reviewing this on the radio, because I make dozens of calls every week, is having to explain to people what it was. I don't think Disney did a really good job explaining, this is the character of Buzz Lightyear. It's not the toy. It's kind of the movie that the toy was based on that Andy got in the first film. So it's just murky. Everyone's like, is it a Toy Story prequel? I go, it's not a prequel. It doesn't have anything to do with the toys. It's about, so that was kind of an uphill battle that the marketing department was not able to overcome. The second thing about the movie is there was no immediacy. There was no, you have to see this or it's going to get spoiled. Nobody cared about the spoilers of this movie. So they could wait a couple weeks or a couple months to see this movie. They didn't worry that they're going to go on Facebook and have it ruined for them. And then the third thing about the movie, and I think this is something that has been largely ignored, but is not an insignificant point. It's a very boy-centric movie. It's the kind of thing that I would have gone wild for as a kid, but I'm a boy. I was a boy. I was a kid that, you know, was into Space Rangers and shoot 'em up and rocket ships. Even though the film has some well-defined and well-made female characters, it's a boy-centric type of movie. I mean, if you want to use those very classical gender terms for how they make movies, you know, it's, these were not toys in Andy's world that were sold to girls. And it wasn't marketed as an overall kids movie. It wasn't marketed for girls and boys. It was very much aimed at boys. And it wasn't even like marketed as a family or generational movie either. It just felt like the kind of movie that Kevin Carr would have loved to have seen when he was six, but my sister maybe not. But then you got to look at the marketplace. Right now, only big tentpoles are doing well. Now, over the last several months, they've taken a breather between tentpoles. They've taken a breather between movies. You know, Spider-Man did really well, and then they came up with Uncharted, which did pretty well, and then it had a couple weeks to burn off. Batman kind of opened in a vacuum and burned off before you got Doctor Strange 2. And yeah, you had Sonic and the bad guy showing up, but those weren't conflicting. They weren't the same kind of movie. But right now, you've got Top Gun still doing very well in the marketplace, as well as Jurassic World, which that gobbles up that boy audience, the kids that love dinosaurs. And I think that that speaks more to the fact that we may not be in a position with movies to open a huge movie every week and expect huge numbers, especially if that movie from the last couple weeks is still really going strong. It's going to cannibalize the box office. And then finally, you got to look at the fact that when it comes to that immediacy factor, we all know this is going to be on Disney Plus in a couple weeks or a couple months. You don't have to wait long. Probably before the kids go back to school, they'll be able to watch Lightyear at home on the big screen TV. And without an immediacy factor, I mean, some people may just not have gotten around to see it. And by the time they're getting around to seeing it, it's on Disney Plus. I mean, look at Doctor Strange. That just showed up on Disney Plus this week. And that thing came out less than 2 months ago. Now, it made $1 billion, and Lightyear's not going to do that. But, I mean, if you can't wait 2 months for a movie, I mean, quite literally, you're still in the summer and you can watch it at home. So I think these two elements, the movie and the marketplace, can explain what happened with Lightyear. But I think this is going to be more of a normal thing that happens if they cram that many releases. It's just the marketplace isn't ready to hold that many movies that everyone wants to see. And so smaller films, even smaller films that are successes, like The Bad Guys, that didn't make $50 million this opening weekend either. Another piece of news I want to talk about is Ms. Marvel, which is another Disney Plus series. That made some news because people were talking about how it's the lowest watched Marvel series with the opening week numbers. It was less than 1 million households watched it over the first week it was out. But with those lower numbers, it's the highest among several minorities, especially Asians and, I'm sure Indians and Pakistanis, because the character's a Pakistani-American girl. And that makes sense because it's a minority family. But this does not mean that these shows are burning out. This show was not your typical Disney Plus series like WandaVision or Loki or Moon Knight that's targeted at a more adult audience. This is very clearly aimed at teenagers, but teenage girls in particular. It really has that Disney Channel vibe to it. And that's okay. I think Disney's trying to enhance its market share. They're not just going for the typical Marvel fan. They're going for the girls who will grow up to become the Marvel fan. And that's very smart and forward thinking on Disney's. The other thing that you do got to realize, it doesn't tie into any other series that we well know. I mean, obviously, WandaVision tied into a bunch of stuff. And Hawkeye had all these repercussions from the Infinity War movies. And Loki, of course, well, he's tied into everything. This one's kind of on its own, aside from her being a big fan of Captain Marvel. So I don't think this is necessarily bad news for Ms. Marvel. And I think this is still going to be a big series for them, especially in terms of building characters. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to talk about is Barbarian. It's a horror movie coming out in theaters on August 31st.
I'm renting this place.
No, I booked it a month ago.
Why don't you come inside and we'll call these idiots. It's dry and there's a lock on the door. You take the bedroom and I'll sleep out here on the couch.
This process might seem overwhelming. But with a little practice, it can soon become a pleasurable experience.
It certainly looks creepy. It looks like it's an interesting idea. I don't want to watch any more trailers. I don't want to watch or read anything more about it because this looks like it's going to be one of those movies that is just loaded with spoilers. And once you get by the idea of this person apparently double booking a rental property and then something crazy happening in the property, I don't want to know anything more. This seems to be the kind of movie that's best gone and clean. So this will probably be the last time you hear about it, but it definitely has my attention. The next one I want to talk about is Smile, which is in theaters on September 30th.
Hi. I know you're nervous. I just want to have a chat.
I'm seeing something no one else can see except for me. It's smiling at me.
Yesterday, a patient in your care died brutally in front of you.
I need to find an explanation for what happened.
I found 20 cases involving 19 victims with a direct line linking them all together.
This looks creepy. I love these kind of movies because they're a new take on different things. And I mean, this clearly feels like it's got shades of The Ring where people get targeted and then another demon or some other force is killing them a certain number of days later. But it looks like it's a unique take on some old horror standards. So yeah, this one I'm looking forward to too. Next up on Fat Guys in the Movies, I got to talk about Elvis the Pelvis and Marcel the Shell with his shoes on.
I can't let you go.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews and talk about one of the big ones this weekend. It's probably not going to top the box office because you still got dinosaurs and even maybe Lightyear might do better than it. Probably not. But you also have Top Gun that might actually win the weekend. But right now, Elvis is going to be trying to hit the charts again. Baz Luhrmann directs this hyper-real look at the life and career of Elvis Presley.
I wish to promote you, Mr. Presley.
Born to a party in a town in jail.
Are you ready to fly?
Ready to fly.
Tomorrow, all of America will be talking about Elvis Presley.
I can't move, I can't sing.
Some people want to put me in jail, so where's moving?
The way he sings is God-given, so there can't be nothing wrong with it.
What seems to be a more obvious thing to talk about with this film is less about the focus, which is Elvis Presley, and more about the director, Baz Luhrmann. Baz Luhrmann, if you don't know what he's done stuff like Moulin Rouge and Romeo and Juliet, the one with Claire Danes and Leonardo DiCaprio. He did Strictly Ballroom, Australia, and The Great Gatsby. His stuff is very lavish and visual, and it's flamboyant and expressive, and it's very, very interesting from a design and cinematography standpoint. All of his movies look impeccable. And that's important because it's his take on Elvis. This is less a movie about Elvis Presley the man and more a movie about Elvis Presley the legend. I mean, even when you dissect this movie, it doesn't really characterize Elvis that much. Elvis is just kind of this iconic image that we follow through the movie. I mean, yeah, he has conversations with people and, you know, he like talks to his mother at points and he's talking to Priscilla and he's talking to different people. But I don't feel like we really get to know Elvis in this movie. It's more the icon that he was, because in a lot of ways, it's not even his movie. It's told from the perspective of Colonel Parker, who is this sleazy guy who basically was his manager for his whole life. And Colonel Parker had some very nefarious dealings and he took advantage of Elvis. The reality is a lot of people took advantage of Elvis. And Elvis was a superstar in a weird way. You know, Parker both made him the massive superstar that he became, but also took advantage of him and caused a lot of problems for him. But this is such a hyper-real version of it. You don't know what's real and what's not. There's things that they overdo it. Like in the first scene where you really see him performing and the girls are in the audience screaming and they focus so much on his movements of his hips that it becomes absurd. I mean, I know that's what was freaking out a lot of the parents at the time, but I mean, it's almost like he has this magic power over them. I mean, it's almost like that fembot sequence in Austin Powers, where Austin Powers uses his mojo to make the fembots blow up. You imagine he has that kind of power. And so it's almost at a cartoon level, but I mean, it's beautiful. I mean, it looks fantastic, but it's also, like I said, told from Colonel Parker's point of view, who's played by Tom Hanks in the weirdest performance you're ever going to see from Tom Hanks outside of Cloud Atlas. I mean, he is so over the top and he chews the scenery. I mean, he just chows down on that scenery, but I mean, it's still a neat movie to watch. It's really uneven though, because I don't know exactly what it's trying to do at a lot of times, and it is way too long. It runs 2 hours and 40 minutes, and at a certain point in the movie, I'm like, oh my god, can you just get fat and die in a toilet soon? You know, I mean, that's kind of the way I felt, especially as I'm rolling into that third hour of the movie. My apologies to Elvis fans out there if I've offended you with that line. I mean, this is visually stunning and it's flamboyant with a fantastic performance by Austin Butler. But it suffers from a bloated running time and some character misdirections, like I said, in the hands of Colonel Parker. At times, it doesn't even feel like it's about Elvis. But when it is about Elvis, Austin Butler, who plays the role, he does a great Elvis impersonation. He's got a real job in Vegas waiting for him if he wants. But it does sort of feel like you are watching an Elvis impersonator, just a really, really good one. It doesn't feel like there's a character to Elvis. There was a documentary made a while back, and I remember seeing it. I got it on DVD or Blu-ray to review once, and it looked at Elvis's life, and it looked at how he aged, and it looked at, by the time he gets to Vegas, he's sort of in the waning end of his career. The screaming girls in the audience are in their 30s, and they're housewives now. They're not teenage girls. They're not throwing their depends on stage like their panties, but, you know, if Elvis didn't die, that's where we would have become. And I'm curious to see, this might be a great companion for that Marilyn Monroe movie to watch, because it sounds like that one's more about her as the icon and less about her as a person. And those are two people, both Elvis and Marilyn Monroe, and, you know, people like James Dean as well, these stars that died relatively young and left their legacy but didn't just kind of run it into the ground. But overall, I mean, this is a neat movie. Baz Luhrmann directs the hell out of this film. It's just, you're in for a long haul when you go see this film. So I'm going to say it rocks, but it still has some real problems with it.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Marcel the Shell with Shoes On. An anthropomorphic shell lives in a man's household and becomes the subject of a documentary in which he tries to find the rest of his family.
It's pretty much common knowledge that it takes at least 20 shells to have a community. My cousin fell asleep in a pocket, and that's why I don't like the saying everything comes out of the wash. Because sometimes it doesn't, or sometimes it does, and they're just like a completely different person. So it's actually only two of us now. Myself and my grandmother, Nana Connie. Sometimes I find my mind wandering. What would my family think? Do you think they could be out there?
Now, apparently, this character of Marcel the Shell with Shoes On, there were little videos that were done by the director, and his name escapes me, I apologize, but it was also, the more recognizable name is Jenny Slate. I think they were in a relationship or married at the time, but they did this series of videos online that were like partially stop motion, where he's interviewing this little shell, and Jenny Slate does the character voice for him. And, you know, she's already got that kind of squeaky voice, and then they modulate it a little bit. And I mean, she really adds a real warmth to him. I mean, you hear it in that opening trailer where she's talking about her cousin who fell into a pocket. Never. And, you know, that's why I don't like the term things come out in the wash. It is a weird setup that these little shells live. I mean, they're like hermit crabs without the crabs. And they're these shells, and they live in these clusters of shells, and one day the whole family disappears. It's just Marcel and his grandmother. And then they decide to try and look for the family. And I mean, it's this really tender and wonderful little ride. I mean, it's this warm feeling that you get watching this movie. I mean, it really overtakes you. I mean, it's very simple. It's this fake documentary where they're interviewing a shell. And you see kind of how it lives its regular life and what it does to try and survive. But then it's also trying to find the lost loved ones in his life. I mean, it's one of the sweetest and most endearing movies of the year. So yeah, I really enjoyed this. I knew nothing about it. I had never seen the original shorts. And it's so great when you have movies that are bombastic and huge, like, you know, Top Gun's like that, and Jurassic World's like that, and Doctor Strange's like that. And in this mix, this morass of loudness and special effects, you get this charming little sweet mockumentary that in some ways is better than all of them. So yeah, if you get a chance to see Marcel the Shell with Shoes On, check it out. It totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
Coming up on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about The Black Phone and The Man from Toronto. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about The Black Phone. Ethan Hawke stars as a man who abducts children in the 70s, told from the point of view of one of his victims.
Would you like to see a magic trick?
I have an announcement to make. One of our students, Finney Blake, was abducted.
What if I could help the police find Finney?
Daddy, I had a dream about it.
What happened in your dream?
He was taken.
By a man with black balloons?
Yes.
We never released those details.
Please, please let the dreams be real.
First of all, if there's anything that this week in movies has taught me, you know, with Elvis and the Black Phone, is it was violent in the 70s. And I grew up in the 70s. One of the things that has a real charm to this movie is it is a period piece. It takes place somewhere in the mid 70s, somewhere in a suburb of Denver. So it's complete middle America. I remember what it was like then. I was a kid at the time. I wasn't as old as most of the characters in this movie because they're sort of late middle school, early high school. But I was in grade school in the late 70s, mid to late 70s. So I knew what it was like. And there was a real panicky stranger danger in the country. Now, in my hometown, there was an abduction and a murder that had happened, and it's horrible, and I'm not going to go into it. And that certainly colored the lives of me and all of my schoolmates, because one day we just came home and everybody had their doors locked and they were doing community outreach and everything. So, I mean, we got hit hard with the stranger danger when I lived in a relatively well-to-do suburb. And even though it's not the same as this, I mean, there wasn't a guy going around snatching kids. It was just one murder that had happened. But I know the sort of panic a suburban town will go into, and they really nail this, especially with the feelings in the 70s of not wanting your kids to go out at certain times. This is directed by Scott Derrickson, who is probably best known for doing the first Doctor Strange movie, but he's done a lot of horror movies. One of the horror movies he did was Sinister, with Ethan Hawke as well. And one of the things I love about Ethan Hawke is, this is a guy who could have totally gone the Tom Cruise or Will Smith route and gone for the big, huge movies and got the biggest paycheck. But he's basically said, you know what, I'm just going to do stuff that I'm interested in. And he's got a really fascinating filmography. Not all of his stuff's good. I mean, he's done some crap. But it's a unique and diverse filmography. And so when you see him in a mainstream movie like this, you know that it's got at least a certain level of quality to it. And he plays the Grabber, which is the name of the character who's out there snatching kids. And at times plays it a little bit too close to a stereotype. But the majority of the time, he really does evoke a real creepiness, a real stranger danger feel to him. But it's told from the point of view of this kid who's kidnapped. So it's less of a horror movie. I mean, I wouldn't call it a horror movie, a direct horror movie. It's more of a suspense movie because it's about this kid. He's trapped in this basement. He doesn't know how to get out, and he's trying to figure out what's going on. And there's this phone in the room that he keeps getting calls on, even though he's not supposed to. I don't want to say much more than that because there's a lot of spoilers to be avoided in, don't even watch the trailers to this. It's best seen as cold as possible. But it is effectively done. I mean, it's unnerving and visceral, and this is a clever take on a standard hostage film. It manages to balance between both. It's not this slasher movie, but it has the feel to it because of the 70s setup. And, you know, even though slashers were much more in the 80s, they still had that 70s aesthetic because fashions take several years to work their way out of the marketplace. So it has that faded sort of film look to it. And part of it, they shoot some of it with actual film stock and 8mm, which gives it that 70s feel to it. But it has some great characters, like the kid's sister, who's trying to find him. She's fantastic in it. And the other thing it does is it has these character arcs, and I think it's gotten criticism for some of these because they're incomplete character arcs, or there's something that you think are trying, like somebody's trying to get a resolution or a redemption arc, but they don't, and then it kind of has a too easy of a wrap-up for certain characters. But I find that as kind of like reality, because people don't change, and there's characters in this that by the time you get to the end of the movie, you're like, well, they're not going to change. But that's the point. Most people don't change. And I think that was a deliberate choice in the writing and execution of this movie. But it's creepy and it's effective, and it really puts you in the seat of the kid knowing he's in danger but not knowing exactly how that danger is going to present itself. So yeah, I'm going to say The Black Phone, that really got me. I enjoyed it. It was right up there along the lines with Sinister. So I'm going to say it totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about The Man from Toronto. Kevin Hart stars as a bumbling suburban husband who is mistaken for a master hitman and must keep up the ruse to stop a terrorist plot.
Why in God's name were you in that cabin?
They wanted me to be the guy that you guys are looking for, but I'm not that guy, but I had to act like I was.
Our only way to find the man from Toronto is if you continue to be the man from Toronto.
Hey, yo, what's my name?
The man that you're talking about is a real crazy person.
Hola. I am the man from Toronto.
My clients think you're me, so
you're going to complete the mission, but you have no idea what I'm going to do to you.
This is on Netflix, and it feels like it certainly has a cast and a director, because it's directed by Patrick Hughes, who did, like, The Hitman's Bodyguard and its sequel from last year. So it certainly has the Hollywood names behind it. And so it feels like it would have gone to the theaters. I don't know if it got snatched up due to the pandemic, but it's now available on Netflix, and it's a throwaway Friday night weekend movie. It's not great. I mean, I'm not going to lie to you. It's not a brilliantly constructed film. We've seen a lot of this before. We've seen a lot of these fish out of water comedies, or the movie where somebody is supposed to be a real butt kicker and a real mean dude, and somebody is trying to pretend to be like that. And we've seen that with the Kevin Hart's played that character a couple times. And so it's not unique in that respect. I mean, I think that really what hinges on it is there's a certain chemistry that Kevin Hart has with Woody Harrelson, and it takes some time to get to them actually even meeting and then having a relationship and trying to get their goals achieved. And I mean, they're like the best part about it, because they definitely work together, and I'd love to see them do some more stuff. It does have some problems with it. Part of it, the narrative's a little bit clunky. And some of it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. There's things thrown in there that they don't fully explain. It's like there's also a lot of, you know, jokes that they'll tell. And the jokes just don't land. But they'll tell them over and over again. You know, so it has these problems to it. You know, it has the excellent chemistry with Kevin Hart and Woody Harrelson. And that makes for a fun film, even if it has some of these jokes that don't land. And they try them multiple times, over and over and over again. And you're like, okay, that didn't land the first time you did it. Why are you trying it a third or fourth or fifth time? Especially when you get to the end of the film. It feels like they also didn't know how to end it. I mean, there's a lot of script problems in this movie. What makes it enjoyable to watch is the two of the guys together. That's really it. And that's what you get with this kind of a movie. Remember the Lost City with Sandra Bullock and Channing Tatum earlier this year. And that was a bit of a hit. Again, it wasn't making $50 million a weekend, but it did substantially well, and it had some real legs. And that was a fish out of water comedy. And so we've seen these movies multiple times before, but you got to get the characters together. So the first part of this movie is a struggle. Fortunately, Patrick Hughes can actually put together a good action movie. It's balancing the action and comedy, and even sometimes just the redemption of the characters don't always work out. You don't want to think too much about this movie. That's the bottom line. You'll just kind of let this movie happen and enjoy it for what it is. Watch it on Netflix. You got it with your subscription. I'm going to be nice and say that it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Coming up on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about the new series, Loot, and the home cinema roundup featuring the bad guys. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. We've wrapped up the big movies and some of the small movies as well that are out there. Also, let me just give a little bit of a plea. Go out and check out The Phantom of the Open. That has finally gotten a wide release out there. And I know I talked about that about a month ago.
If you could do anything, what would you do?
Golf.
Golf?
I'm going to have a crack at the British Open.
Don't adjust the television. This is actually happening.
How does it feel to have shot the worst round in the history of the Open?
That's hard to tell. It's the first round I've ever played.
That's a great movie. You know, I would forego Elvis and go see The Phantom of the Open. That's a really sweet little film. So check that out. wanted to give a little bit of a shout out to that film. But let's talk about something that's new on Apple TV Plus, and that is the TV series Loot, meaning money, not the medieval stringed instrument that looks like a pregnant guitar. Maya Rudolph stars as a divorcee who ends up with $87 billion and tries to find a purpose in life.
You never think stuff like this is going to happen to you.
But I'm much better now.
No.
Molly, come in here, girl.
We're not used to meeting celebrities.
I'm not a celebrity.
Yes, you are. You're like the most famous cheated on woman on the planet.
Let's be honest. You only showed up today because you got divorced.
I never did the work to find out who I am.
A part of me wants to hate you, Molly. But you pull us together and you made us better.
Oh, I think I'm going to cry.
Sort of like The Man from Toronto, this type of story has been done before. The rich person trying to find themselves. You know, Overboard is a great example of that. You know, we just had the remake a couple years ago with that. And of course, the original one there. You know, sometimes they're like minor characters or secondary characters, like the Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt had the character that was played by Jane Krakowski, who was this super wealthy socialite who was having marital problems and trying to find their way. We've seen these movies and TV series multiple times before. Arthur II on the Rocks, that's another great example. That's, of course, you know, Dudley Moore when he's the billionaire who then loses his money and has to try and still live as a regular person. That is the biggest hurdle to get through. I mean, that's the premise of the show, too. But it's a hurdle to get through because the entire setup of this is Maya Rudolph's character is completely shallow and doesn't know what it's like to live in the real world. I mean, she's got billions of dollars. Most people don't understand how much billions of dollars are. If you have $87 billion, which is what she has, if you're a person who has probably more than your average person has in savings, say you have $10,000 in savings, that's your net worth. Her net worth's $87 billion. Your net worth's, say, $10,000, because that's what you got in the bank. Imagine you taking 10 bucks out. That's like her taking $100 million out of. I mean, for what you'd buy for 10, but you get McDonald's for 10 bucks and then you get change back. A trip to McDonald's is like $10 million to her. So like once you get below that threshold of $10 million to somebody who has that much money, you can't even that doesn't exist. It's just it's a fart in the wind in terms of money. And that's the big problem with this is because people who have that much money, they are out of touch because they live in a world where they can buy anything, any material want they have, they can fulfill. I mean, yeah, it doesn't buy you love. You know, we know all the cliches and stuff. There's the old saying that money can't buy love, but it can certainly buy a lot of the things that you need. So her trying to grow as a character, that also becomes a problem. As you're watching the series, I just don't buy her as developing and her character getting better. You know, she still is a shallow individual. She just maybe is a little nicer about it. And the thing is, once you make those characters change, Schitt's Creek was another one that had very, very wealthy people suddenly having to live like normal people. And for her, she doesn't even have to live it. She just is trying to improve her image. So she still has all the money and all the accoutrement. And everyone loves her because she's, you know, an exciting person to talk to. But she still doesn't live in the real world, and it's still playing games, and it's still her playing house. And that is the massive hump that I can't get over with this show. I mean, otherwise, I think it's a well-made series. It's got Adam Scott as her husband, and I like to think of this as like, you know, like maybe this is an unwritten prequel to Severance with him. This movie has some funny parts, but that fundamental problem of finding any sort of empathy with somebody who not only has that much money, because, yeah, you can have somebody as a billionaire and be empathetic with them, but somebody who is that shallow as a character, at least at the beginning of the series, and then you have to grow and change, and at a certain point you make those changes, and you either have to backtrack and make her shallow again, which is what happened on The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt with Jane Krakowski's character. They kept kind of flipping back to that. She'd grow, and then they'd be like, well, she's not funny anymore, so let's, you know, have her regress. So yeah, I mean, it's just sort of like the setup's interesting, but while it has plenty of funny moments, it's just a hard pill to swallow to muster much sympathy for a character that literally has everything she wants. So I'm going to have to say that Loot kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Today's spotlight is on The Bad Guys, which is now available on DVD and Blu-ray. This came out earlier this year. I mentioned it in the box office segment, and it is a movie that actually did quite well for what it was. It was a smaller animated film, and it had quite a bit of success. So in The Bad Guys, a game of nefarious creatures pretend to become good guys in order to pull off the heist for a gold MacGuffin.
We're the bad guys. And this is the crew. Mr. Snake, Miss Tarantula, Mr. Piranha, and Mr. Shark. And rounding out the crew is me, the big bad wolf. We may be bad, but we're so good at it.
If you want to stay out of jail, you need to go good.
What are you doing?
We're gonna pretend to go good. The bad guys become the good guys so we can stay the bad guys. You know what I'm saying?
Before I even talk about the movie, there's some weird things about this. Because the characters are like, you got a wolf and a shark and a tarantula and a snake and a piranha. And like, they live in a real world with humans. So, I mean, they're walking around and talking to people. And like, the mayor of the city is a fox. Not an attractive woman, but an actual honest-to-God fox. So one of the characters, who's voiced by Richard Ayoade from the IT Crowd, he plays this guinea pig. And there's a scene where they go to a lab and liberate a bunch of guinea pigs that are being tested on. I'm like, whoa, hold on a second. You know, guinea pigs are actual functioning members of society, and you're still doing scientific experiments on that? That's kind of horrifying, isn't it? Don't think about that stuff. You don't want to think too much about this. It feels like it was originally designed to be like Zootopia or Sing, where it's all animals, but then they just made them all into human beings, except for these animals. For some reason, a shark is wandering around, and people are like, oh, a shark, because they're scared of it, but nobody's like, why is a shark walking around and talking? But it's a cartoon, so it works. And I mean, it's fun. It's a fun, breezy, quick movie. It's got a great voice cast. And with this unique animation and a punchy style, it's a real fun family adventure. And when I say the unique animation style, the design is different than necessarily a Pixar movie or a Shrek movie. I read somewhere that it drew inspiration from the animation that was done for Into the Spider-Verse, which of course they're doing another movie of that. And I love that. I love stylized animation. And not everything has to look exactly the same. And in this day and age, you know, everything is generally CGI. You don't get a whole lot of 2D cell animation anymore. But this stuff looks really cool, and it's punchy, and you know, like Sam Rockwell plays the wolf, and like Craig Robinson, I think, plays the shark, and Awkwafina plays the tarantula. So it's got this fantastic little voice cast that goes together. And it's just a fun little movie. I enjoyed the heck out of it. I really was surprised because I'd not heard much about it. And then it did well enough in theaters. I mean, it wasn't a massive hit, but it was certainly a profitable movie that had a good run in the theaters and families went to go see it. And I said, well, maybe this is pretty good. And so I had a chance to check it out before the release of the Blu-ray. And I was surprised. I'm surprised they didn't promote it more through critics because they didn't screen it for me. I think they screened it in Cleveland, but you know, with gas prices the way they are, I'm not going to drive to Cleveland to see everything. But they really should have been screening this as wide as possible and getting great word of mouth because, you know, it's a fun little movie. I enjoyed it. I got to say, it was a lot of fun. So I'm going to say The Bad Guys totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
Also available new on disc, we've got The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent and the Criterion Collection of Shaft. On VOD, we've got Crimes of the Future. And then if you want to check out the streaming services, Disney Plus has Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness, plus the Obi-Wan Kenobi finale. And then on Peacock, you can check out Jaws just in time for the 4th of July and The Thing, which has its 40th anniversary of release this weekend. That's also available on Peacock. And that wraps up the Home Cinema Roundup. So next week, I'm going to be talking about Minions and Mr. Malcolm's List. And until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.